Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Agla, and I'm the host of UEG Podcast, educational and hopefully fun dive into GI world and beyond. And today's episode is a little different from what we are used to. Instead of a classic interview, you'll be listening to a roundtable discussion recorded in 2025 as part of UEG online course on the impact of polyp detection in colonoscopy. It captures an unfiltered exchange between experts on real-world dilemmas surrounding quality metrics, pathology, serrated lesions, surveillance strategies, and artificial intelligence. I strongly recommend watching the full online course after listening to this episode. It's available on Gutflix via the link in the show notes, and it's completely free. It features practical tips on improving your ADR, scoping techniques, optical diagnosis, AI use, surveillance intervals, case discussions, and so much more. Now let's get started and let the experts introduce themselves.
So welcome to the roundtable discussions. My name is Raf Bischops. I'm a gastroenterologist, and I have a special interest in advanced imaging and therapeutic interventions. I work at the University Hospitals in Leuven in Belgium.
My name is Manuele Furnari. I'm associate professor in gastroenterology at the University of Jena and part of the UEG education team.
I'm Veronique van der Voort, and I'm a gastroenterologist and advanced endoscopist at the University Hospital in Limoges in France.
And I am Peter Sinonkel. I'm a senior clinical fellow in University Hospitals Leuven, training in gastroenterology and endoscopy.
So after all the lectures, we're going to discuss some hot issues and some hot topics that I think most of us are confronted with in daily life. So the first thing I want to touch upon is actually the histology as golden standard, right? So the pathologist is king or queen in our decision-making. We depend on what they write in their reports. But I must say that often we are confronted with some contradictions. So it happened more than once to me that I'm absolutely sure I saw a polyp and resected it, and the pathology comes back as no polyp found. That's one thing. And then when you apply the optical diagnosis and you clearly see the nice type 2 pit pattern, it comes back as a hypoplastic polyp while you are absolutely sure it's an adenoma. And you can go into discussion. And the third thing, maybe, is the serrated, right?
Yeah.
Which is an important polyp to find. And it may very well be that you find a 10 millimeter polyp in the right colon, and then you see, well, it has all the features of the WASP classification. That says to me, as an endoscopist, this is most likely a serrated lesion, and it comes back as a hypoplastic polyp. So I think these are three scenarios, the scenarios that we encounter quite often in our daily practice. So my first question to you, Manuel, with regard to the serrated lesion, the last example, how should we deal with that? I mean, if you're absolutely sure as an endoscopist, it's a right-sided 10 millimeter lesion, because we learned from Peter that it's a different interval for that patient. That would be like a 3-year interval instead of a 10-year interval. But then it comes back as a hyperplastic polyp, and all of a sudden it's 10 years again. So what should we do with that?
Yeah, actually it happens to me a couple of times that I was also collecting the pictures and say, oh, I can finally show nice size serrated lesion. But at the end, when I saw the report, say, oh, they say hyperplastic, so maybe I'm not so good at optical diagnosis, or I cannot show this video case because actually it's not as size serrated. But probably we must think about either a problem into, let's say, acceptance that the new diagnosis for serrated lesions are that is enough to just see or found a certain disrupted serrated creep into the specimen. And another thing aspect is that we might have this distortion also just in the very basal layer of the specimen and not in all the through all the thickness of the specimen, and therefore sometimes there's a superficial cut of the specimen. These specimens sometimes arrive to the pathologist that actually are quite distorted or very small, and they might be therefore triggered by technical issues. And this comes again to your questions, like should we then rely more on our diagnosis, or we still stick to the histology report?
So, but then, Veronique, how can it be that we see the polyp? Mm-hmm. It's, let's say, the tiny polyp that you taught us to take off now with cold snare, but then the pathologist says, I can't find anything.
Yeah.
So how do I explain that?
Exactly, it's a good question, and I think it happened to a lot of us in clinical practice. And as I showed in the video, performing a nice cold snare polypectomy, it includes removing the polyp in the middle with a nice rim of normal mucosa around the polyp. And the pathologist, he cuts the specimen that he receives. And it's possible that if the lesion is so small that he only cuts the normal mucosa, and so the report will say it's just a normal mucosa, we didn't find a polyp.
Yeah.
So I think there is some room to really rely on your optical diagnosis. If you're really sure, you can go back to pictures, or you can... So I think we should still keep on relying on our own optical diagnosis if we do it correctly.
Okay, but that's a bit controversial. Huh? So Peter, you explained to us the intervals for screening and when to do the next colonoscopy after screening colonoscopy. And let's say that is just polyp number 5, so to speak, to really make it a dilemma. So what should we do with that? Should we trust our own eyes and say, I saw that adenoma, I did a nice classification, and I'm like, let's say... Like you say, 80% sure it is like that. So what should we do with that?
Well, that's actually, again, a good question. And I believe that it's a dual answer. In the fact that we know that there is a mismatch between optical diagnosis and histology, we know that in the literature it's been written up to 15%. And what Manuela said was very important. You should focal document. Because you can go back to the polyp and see, okay, maybe I was wrong, maybe I was right, and I still think there's a polyp. So if you don't have any photo documentation, you can't go back, so there is no discussion anymore. And if you're still very convinced there is a fifth adenoma, and the pathologist says, well, it's not, I think you have to look for yourself, how well am I trained in optical diagnosis? But if you're very convinced, I should discuss it with the patient and say, well, it's a bit conflicting here, but in my opinion, I would always apply the most stringent surveillance interval then and say, well, we'll rescope you after 3 years as the guidelines prescribe. If it's okay, you can go back to screening interval. I think there is quite a little harm in rescoping patients after 3 years, whereas taking them in an interval of 10 years, there might be more risk of a post-colonoscopy colorectal cancer, although the absolute risk for these PCCRCs is very little. Mm. But you should be the one patient not being discussed with having a post-colonoscopy colorectal cancer, then you might get in trouble.
Yeah, but now you put yourself in a very specific place because I'm going to challenge you. Mm-hmm. We heard from Manuele that we should use the endocuff, we should use virtual chromatoscopy to improve our detection skills. You showed us the data on artificial intelligence. Our ADR is skyrocketing, our number of polyps per colonoscopy goes up. So we are confronted with another paradox, which is we do our utmost best to detect every single polyp. But paradoxically, if we look at the guideline that you showed, it's going to be very easy to reach that 5 polyp bar, right? So although we do a better job and take everything out, we're going to see those patients more often back. So do you think we need to change these guidelines in the future depending on how the endoscopy was done, on how the quality was assessed, and are we good enough to assess this ourselves? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a difficult question first. In my belief, again, it all comes down to documentation. Before you can discuss this, we really need to document what we've done because high quality endoscopy, I can just write down in my report, I did a high quality endoscopy, but you should report it. You should document the fact that you intubated the cecum, that you have a good bowel preparation in the patient, and that you did anything to optimize your optical diagnosis using, for instance, virtual chromoendoscopy. But again, using virtual chromoendoscopy entails the fact that you're trained in using it. You can switch on the button, but if you don't know where to look for, of course, it's useless. So that's one thing. Documentation is very important. And indeed, using CADe might increase the fact, and that has already been shown in the literature as well, that we increase the diminutive polyp detection, but it's mainly on the left side, and it's most probably a hyperplastic one, also in the literature. But of course, if there's the fifth adenoma, that gets you in a dual position. And again, I would then discuss it. If there is like an agreement between you and the pathologist for, okay, this is a fifth adenoma, I think you should apply what we currently use. Yeah? Of course, in case there is a mismatch between what you think as an endoscopist and what the pathologist thinks, I think, at least, that, but it's my personal opinion, I would again discuss it with the patient and maybe rescope the patient one time in an earlier interval than the ones without that.
But you know, if
he's evading a little bit the hot potato.
Yeah, I would say.
So it's like,
yeah, but,
what so, about, do should we, the question is, should we change the guideline? Because we do a better job. We use the endocuff.
No.
We use the AI. We do the best bowel prep. We take our time and look at everything.
What's the clinical impact?
So now we found 10 polyps and we find 10 polyps instead of 2, which we, in the low quality endoscopy, we might have missed 8.
Yeah.
And we see the patient back in 10 years. We do a very good job. We find 10 and we see the patient back in 3 years. So this is a paradox somehow that we need to solve in the future guidelines, no? What do you think?
Yeah, well, currently I wouldn't change it because we know the data up to today and it's not in there. And of course, this will be considered during writing these guidelines. But as Veronique says, the clinical impact of finding these small diminutive polyps is very little. It's very little. So probably it won't be cost efficient to re-scope patients after 3 years.
But please let me keep him still in the corner fighting, because you mentioned the report and they said I'm writing down I made a quality endoscopy. But in this setting, maybe the AI can help us about making, let's say, a standardized report, but also proving that you spent enough time on endoscopy, the preparation was objectively good, not just because you said this might be good, or actually often happened the opposite. People say it was not good enough, so come back. But if artificial intelligence say, no, that was a good preparation, you shouldn't reschedule the patient again. So what do you think? Should we have mandatory the AI in our report or not?
For the future, definitely yes, but I think the current algorithms aren't well enough. Speaking of CADx, because that's what it's going for, CADe has been proven to be implementable and to improve your detection with an overall 20% on ADR. But for CADx, there is no such data. We show that there is indeed some improvement, but also the other way around. And what it does show is that the clinical impact is not truly efficient. We do not meet the standards for resect and discard. We do not meet the standards for SODA criteria. So we can use it. There is no harm in using CADx. But currently speaking, I would not trust the AI to just say, well, this was a high quality optical diagnosis confirmed by AI and the report is done, this was all good. For the bowel prep, that's another question. There are some good systems, but again, they're very limited and they're not really implemented in clinics yet.
And Raf, sorry, I want to make you a question because you are involved also in education. What do you think could be the impact of having AI, at least CADe, showing polyp all the times, and when you switch off, or is going to be also, let's say, a long-term effect on the detection rate, or is going to make people more lazy, and the day you don't have the CADe system, you are losing actually polyp. Yeah. What do you think?
That's a very good question, and actually, as a matter of fact, at ESG days this year, there was an abstract on that showing that there is no descaling. So that was the first one, I think, that was quite reassuring with that aspect, because obviously it's something to be concerned about. So apparently people are still finding the way without the GPS, which is good, I think. So I want to take it back to the optical diagnosis. So back to you, Veronique. So you talked a lot about that. And this resect and discard or diagnose and leave in situ strategy, we've been talking about it for almost 15 or maybe 20 years by now, and still it's not there. But there are also some new molecular insights in terms for specifically for the hyperplastic polyps. So we now can make a distinction between goblet cell rich hyperplastic polyps, you have microvesicular hyperplastic polyps, and especially the latter, they can harbor more BRAF mutations that you alluded to for the serrated pathway. So some theories that are out there now that maybe we are looking at different histological features in a transition from goblet cell rich to microvesicular hyperplastic polyp that may be on the way to become a serrated polyp as well. So do you think to leave it in situ, is that a good thing to do, or do you think we're ever going to get there, or are we going to go more for resect and discard? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you have a good point saying that these strategies are already being under development for 15, maybe even 20 years. And even at this moment, they're not implemented widely. There are studies done to question gastroenterologists why they don't implement this strategy in clinics. They are afraid, they are not confident, and the sensitivity that is requested by the SODA criteria is up to 80 or 90% to apply this strategy in your clinic. So that's quite high, and I understand that endoscopists don't feel confident enough or aren't confident enough to be able to adopt this strategy. And with the new data on the hyperplastic polyps or the serrated polyps, this is not implemented in the studies on the resect and discard or leave in situ strategies, but I think this should certainly be taken into account.
So with that respect, the resect and discard is a bit easier, right? Because you can make an optical diagnosis and maybe,
we might miss
the fifth, or we diagnose one too many adenoma, but at least it's been taken out and stopped, right? I agree. And also the sensitivity there that you need is only 80%, while for the leave in situ you need 90%. And I don't think there's any cadic system that achieves that at this point, Peter, does it?
No.
All right, so going a bit more to the advanced polyps and the optical diagnosis, Fidini, can you explain to us one more time how should people look at these polyps to make a good optical diagnosis if you see something that is 3-4 centimeters? How do you deal with that, and how much time does that take?
It's important to take time to do a thorough assessment, to take time to document well. If you're doing the resection yourself, it's important, but also if you want to refer the patient, so the patient can be referred with adequate documentation, adequate information, so that the advanced endoscopist can make a decision on planning in terms of scheduling, but also if the lesion looks more suspected than the referral gastroenterologist thinks, there can also still be a change in strategy at the moment the patient is referred. So I described 5 steps to do an adequate optical diagnosis. And actually, if we take a step back, you always start from afar, actually, when assessing a polyp. You look at the polyp, you look how big is the polyp, you assess the location of the polyp, so where is it situated, and then you go closer and you look at the morphology. At first, you also look from afar. So is this a granular lesion or a non-granular lesion? Are there features of submucosal invasive cancer, like a macronodule? Is there a depression? And that are all things that you can see from quite from afar. And then you will go a little bit more closer. And every time you go closer and closer, assessing the lesion into more detail, first with white light, with high definition white light, looking for vascular and surface patterns that are disrupted. And of course, then you use the virtual or dye-based chrome endoscopy to search for lesions or for areas that are suspected for harboring invasive cancer.
And how difficult is it to learn that? What do you think is the learning curve if you teach your fellows in Limoges to do that? Is it so difficult, or?
Experience will learn it. You have to do it a lot. First together with somebody who is experienced in it, who can correct you. But you can also train during staff meetings with pictures and with experience from others or videos. So it takes some time to learn it, but I think it definitely it's worth to become proficient in a good, thorough optical diagnosis.
And it takes also patience, because very often people just say a polyp and say, oh, it's big, let's schedule again, and took 2 pictures instead. You had to spend many minutes, I hope, but let's say looking carefully and try to see what is the, let's say, more disrupted area on the surface, not just now the taking closest picture, because you have also to pick up which are the pit pattern or the macroscopic aspect that actually will change completely your decision.
Exactly.
So this is a matter of patience, especially if you have 88 centimeters or 10 centimeters polyp, you have to document it very well.
And that takes a long time to do a really good assessment of large lesion. But in fact, also for residents or for gastroenterologists in training, every lesion that you encounter, also the small ones, you should use them for training. Is this a hyperplastic polyp? Is this an adenoma? You should train yourself just looking at the lesions with white light, with virtual chrome endoscopy. So every opportunity you should use to train yourself in this.
But I want to also to address, because we are speaking of artificial intelligence, chromoendoscopy, and high definition. But at the end, everything depends on the quality of the preparation, because even if we are in Leuven and we have all the technical devices and you are very skilled, but then the patient arrived and is poorly prepared, then you wasted the slot. The patient had, of course, discomfort in coming there, and you cannot even proficiently try to look at this polyp. So how do you think we should manage the patient and also the bowel preparation? Do you have any tricks and tips that can you tell us?
Yeah, I think the most important message here is that you cannot just give the appointment to the patient with the instructions and say, go ahead, read it and do what's written, right? And that is really crucial. I think just spending 5 minutes with the patient to go through the bowel preparation and give clear instructions, you know, with a timeline, then you take the first dose, then you take the second dose, depending on when your colonoscopy is scheduled, It's really important. So I always put it to the patient like this. I say, we do our best on our side. We make sure we do a safe endoscopy and a high quality endoscopy, but this is your part of the job, right? So they need to be feel responsible for that part and understand the importance of what you just said, an excellent bowel preparation, because all the rest doesn't matter if you don't start with a good bowel preparation. So these 5 minutes, either by you as a physician or a trained nurse, are really crucial just to make sure you communicate that. And also to the GPs that might be watching this training, I think it's really crucial to take the time to explain that, because if they just make an appointment on the phone and the endoscopy unit and just say you can go there, the patient may even show up without preparation. So and that's a shame, because they take time off of work, they come to the hospital, and so it's a big burden on your planning, it's a big burden for the patient. So it's really, I mean, it seems trivial, but it's so important.
You should create a virtual gastroenterologist that can
discuss
with the GP and with the patient how to be prepared.
And this is on top of even digital apps, you know, or SMS services that patients are warned, oh, just remember, you have to start your diet now, or now it's time to start your first dose of the bowel prep and so on. I think this is what we showed in the presentation, but it all starts with some simple instructions and good graphics that you give to them to make sure they know what's going on and what product they need to take. Yeah.
And do you think there are also some aspects that should be taken into consideration, not just the patient compliance to the preparation, but also I'm thinking about comorbidities or other factors that could influence the patient, but also your choice and for the bowel preparation?
Yes, absolutely. I think these are really crucial factors. So we also need to reconsider or consider the fact that patients may need to do this investigation again. And I think the data that you all showed here, especially with regard to interval and the risk of post-colonoscopy colorectal cancer, that really indicates that if we want to prevent cancer and we find medullary polyps, then the patient needs to come back. So if they have a very bad experience from the start, and if you actually ask them, most of the burden is the bowel prep. So I think we need to look at the evidence, and most patients actually prefer low volume. So I think this is the first thing to start. And then you need to see, it's all about taste. Eh? So we cannot dispute that. It's a nice Latin saying about that. But that's the first part.
Yeah?
So. And then the second thing is then the comorbidities. I think the first thing to question yourself is, does the patient really need a colonoscopy? If we're talking about somebody with severe renal failure or severe cardiac morbidity, low ejection fractions, we always need to discuss with the referring physician, is this really necessary? This is an invasive procedure. The bowel prep may be dangerous for the patient. So if they still need it, I think the best way to do that is then, unfortunately, go for large volume, but isotonic pack solutions. I think they are the safest in terms of electrolyte disturbances. Another difficult group, I think, is the ones with chronic constipation, because if you look at all the trials for bowel preparation, none of them actually include patients with constipation. They're always excluded, even if they're on systematic one pack bag per day, especially if they're on prokinetic, they're all excluded. So all we see in those studies does not apply to the population who is on chronic laxatives. So here you need to think twice. So, and what you need to do is first see how is the stool movements in these patients per week on their therapy. If this is like every day, probably you can prescribe a normal bowel prep. If they pass stools only once or twice per week, then maybe you need to reconsider how you do this. And maybe add some isotonic bowel prep the days before, or increase the laxative therapy the days before, and then go ahead with the bowel preparation.
And what about the prokinetics?
Yeah, there's no data about that. I think to prescribe, for instance, prucalopride is probably very expensive for them, because 70 euros for a box, and that... And
at the beginning, you had also side effects in the beginning.
But if they're on it, you can always increase the doses, maybe, or if they take it on and off, you can say, okay, take it systematically. So what I want to say, basically, is they need a personalized approach, and you need to take this in consideration. You still may go wrong. In the worst case, if they need very large volumes, we even provide a preparation through a nasogastric tube, where we can even add 6 or 7 liters. But that is then done in an inpatient situation, I think. I don't know how you approach this.
No, yeah, indeed, depends on the setting. If they are inpatient and they actually need extra care, because we notice that their preparation is always, or very often, not always, very often is worst, even if there are nurses 24 hours per day next to them, and because probably low motility and comorbidities. That's why we make sometimes we try to double or at least to increase the dosage of the preparation. And just thinking about the therapeutic aspect. So if you are planning to remove a big lesions, are you doing an extra preparation to be sure the bowel is going to be perfectly clean, or you just take to the traditional?
In general, we do a standard preparation. Of course, also personalized if it's necessary to give a higher dosage. But in general, we give a standard preparation. Also for rectal lesions, so for rectal EMR or ESD, the patient should take a complete preparation.
So more safe.
Yeah, exactly.
Safer.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Manuela, you also talked about screening and how this actually affects maybe colorectal cancer mortality. But I may actually challenge you a little bit on that, because we had a Nordic trial, I think already 2 years ago, Peter, if I'm not mistaken, right? And that actually didn't show effectively a decrease in mortality. There was a decrease in colorectal cancer as such. So does that still hold? Do we still need to do screening colonoscopy? And then what modality should we use at this stage? Should it be FIT-based, or should we go for primary colonoscopy screening? Can you shed a light on that?
Well, first of all, there are data about the fact that using the FIT test actually increased the adherence to the program, to the compliance, because, as you said, patients are still scared about colonoscopy. First, because they think it is a painful examination, and that's why I stress the fact that sedation is really a game changer in the last decades. And another aspect is the bowel preparation. And even if they didn't feel anything during the endoscopy, they are scared to redo again the preparations. And there is also some confusion about the FIT test, no? Some of them say, okay, I have done a colonoscopy, then the year after they already repeat the FIT test, and if it's positive, they get stressed about, then I should redo a colonoscopy. And so the point is, we first of all must be aware that the FIT testing is perfect, so it might be false positive, but as a strategy, you know, also to, let's say, save some money, the FIT test is still, let's say, a useful tool, at least, if not powerful, but useful, because increase the patient awareness about the risk of cancers. And there is also data that inviting patient for, let's say, just have a colonoscopy or decide to screen the patient with the FIT test first actually provide a non-inferiority results from the FIT test and increasing the adherence. Mm-hmm. And another aspect is that we should increase our capability to predict the risk of the patient, because, as I said, it's at the moment, it's not possible to say you cannot undergo colonoscopy, because you are going to be for 100% without cancer in your life. But as you said, maybe digitalizations and the possibility to get access to the personal information through also big data analysis will improve this knowledge. And the way we are considering the selection of the population will be changed. But for the moment, I will stay with the FIT test age, so older than 50 years old. Eventually, think about the 45 years
old. Exactly, I was about to ask you that.
I was trying to avoid that age question because it's still an increasing the cost, and the amount actually of cancer that is going to be reduced are quite low, right? Mm-hmm. And especially if you, as you mentioned, that at the end, the mortality is not going to change. Yep. So why are we doing that? No? So this is still, I think, something we have to work on.
Yeah. One might argue, Peter, that despite the fact that we don't decrease mortality, maybe that's because of the better chemotherapy we have nowadays. So it's still a large burden on society, no?
Don't you think? I imagine. I think chemotherapy, I don't think, is the problem, but it's more the immune therapy and the biologicals they start using, which are very good therapies in certain cases, but they are also a quite large burden on the socioeconomics of your country. Mm-hmm. But of course, the digestive oncologists use that trial to say, well, why still screen with colonoscopy? Because our treatments have become so good that patients don't die anymore from their colorectal cancer. And you have to give them that. Partially, that's true. But of course, using therapies with 2,000 euros a month also gives you a large burden.
That's pretty cheap, what you say there. It's probably more, no?
Even that is already quite expensive for a society, I think. It's a discussion we have to make. Mm-hmm. But I believe screening FIT-based is still the first way to go, although your cancer mortality doesn't really decrease by it.
Yeah. Okay, so that brings me to the last part of this round table. It's the organ preserving revolution. We have it throughout the GI tract, we have it upper GI. The Japanese has pushed this very much with their ESD. So first to you, Peter. I mean, you've been talking about AI, and we saw how difficult it is to detect or to make a correct optical diagnosis and really estimate, okay, is this a submucosally invading lesion? Is this a T2 cancer? Do you envision that artificial intelligence will be effectively helping us in selecting patients better for the correct therapy?
I think so. Not for now. I think current systems aren't capable of doing that. There are reports of algorithms capable of assessing submucosal invasive cancer with good accuracies, but not optimal. But I think, as Manuela already said, it all comes down to risk stratification. There are already some NLP systems that are capable of detecting cancer throughout just medical files, using medical files. Before we even as a physician know that these patients are at risk for a certain cancer. So if we can include these type of algorithms together with very well established detection models, categorizing models and models estimating invasive cancer, I think that will give you a holistic image of the patient and might guide you through a certain management. But we're not yet there.
But I think the key for that will always be that we have these nice high-definition images that are like almost perfect, right? So, and I think for everybody who does these interventions, it is, let's say it honestly, very disappointing sometimes the quality of images that we get, if we get them at all, and the video. So give some tips and tricks, Veronique. How can we optimize that, and how would our patients benefit from a better effort to that aspect?
So it's actually a part of the optical diagnosis. Everything that you see with your own eyes, you should document it with a photo or with a video, allowing external physicians or the expert endoscopists that you will send the patient to, allowing them to do the same assessment as you did. So starting from afar, going closer, using white light first, and then chrome endoscopy, looking for small areas that are disrupted, and really taking pictures of every zone, really make a good report describing everything you see, and then referring the patient or discussing it in an MDT meeting, asking advice from colleagues. Even if you want to resect the lesion yourself, it never harms to discuss the patient with colleagues to have a consensus on the treatment and then go ahead with the treatment.
Yeah, because I don't think we can underestimate the effect it has on a patient, right? Because you do, for the first time, your colonoscopy, and then you see and you have to tell them, look, there is a big thing. Yep. I'm not really sure what it is. Yep. I'm going to send you to Dr. Van der Voort to have a better look, or to Professor Jeremy Jack to have a better look. So they have to wait before they get there,
yeah.
right? So just those 5 minutes spent to take those images and that
exactly.
footage
yeah.
can make such a difference because yeah. they can send the images to you. You as an expert can look at it and
yeah.
say, okay, I need 2 hours, 1 hour. You can schedule the slot.
Yeah.
And all you need to do is the informed consent, which
yeah.
which you can do like in a short outpatient clinic to explain the procedure.
Yeah.
But otherwise, they have to come back. You need to prep them. You cannot schedule the therapy because you don't
know
whether you need 1 or 3 hours,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So these
yeah.
5 minutes extra make such a big
yeah.
difference for the patients.
Exactly.
What in terms of what you're going to say to them, you say, I'm going to send you videos to the referring doctor.
Yeah.
They can have a look at it, and we're going to decide for you within a week what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they need to get a schedule for a new appointment,
yeah.
new bowel
prep. You lose time,
and
which is also important when... a doctor receives a file of a patient, the images are also important to schedule the delay of the intervention. So is it an ugly lesion, then you will plan it as fast as possible. If it is a benign lesion but with a macronodule or something that doesn't worry you at this moment, you can plan the patient a little bit further, like in 8 weeks or in with a more acceptable delay.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a lesion that's already suspect, you should not wait 2-3 months and schedule it in the future. So also that, therefore, the documentation is important to schedule the patient at that moment, but also schedule the delay for the planning.
And is the documentation, I'll just be advocacy for the devil, is the documentation of photo enough, or should we biopsy the lesions first and send you the report as well? And secondly, should we mark the lesion? Because, of course, if it's a lesion of 60 millimeters, it's probably not hard to find it again. But if it's a lesion of about 20 millimeters, because it's always an estimation, should I ink the lesion or not?
So videos, photos and videos, if it's possible. That's what's preferred. Biopsies are not necessary. There is a high chance of sampling error that you biopsy the superficial part, of course, which shows low-grade dysplasia or high-grade dysplasia. Mm. It doesn't exclude that there's cancer
yeah.
Or in an ulcerated part that you didn't see or in a deeper part of the lesion. So biopsies are not contributive. Should you mark the lesion? Of course, for large lesions, no. For smaller lesions, if you do a good description with a scope, a straightened scope, you describe the centimeters from the anal verge. In general, we don't mark the lesions, and we also don't expect it from referring doctors to...
So basically, save the time, not taking
exactly.
biopsies, not putting the ink in, and spend that time taking good footage
yeah.
and good
and
image
good report.
And video acquisition
exactly.
and a good report.
Yeah.
So I think we can round up the round table here with some... very nice messages. Actually, it's a very simple message. 2 times 5 minutes can change the management of the patient. 5 minutes for good bowel instruction, right? So they do it right from the first time, and you can assess and find everything that is there. And a second 5 minutes, if you find something of significance, to really take the time, those 5 minutes, good video documentation, discuss it with an expert center, hook on to an expert center that has all the therapeutic armamentarium that you can offer to a patient, and that can really be a game changer for your specific patient.
Yep.
So
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Nice conclusion.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.